I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Nicola Ulibarri. She is a PhD student at Stanford University in the Emmett Interdisciplinary Program in Environment and Resources, and she will be giving a talk titled Water, the Challenge of Sustainability on Tuesday, December 18th at 5:30 in the Santa Fe Community Foundation. It's part of the Water Matters series, sponsored by Amigos Bravos. It's a free event and open to the public. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So you are from Taos. Is that how you got interested in water issues and water policy?
That's definitely a big part of it. I think anybody growing up in New Mexico, it's hard to not notice that we're in droughts a lot, where there are forest fires. Yes, there's just a lot of awareness about water issues in general, I feel like, in New Mexico. Also, my parents worked quite a bit in the environmental field. My dad actually was on the board of Amigos Bravos when I was growing up, and so some of that I learned a little bit more specifically about some of the more deep problems that Amigos Bravos was working on. That was the genesis, I think, of my interest, yeah.
So when you look at the Southwest and you look at New Mexico specifically, what kind of water scarcity are we seeing and why?
So the challenge is that it is a desert, and there never really has been a lot of water to go around in the Southwest. There's a growing population, and so you end up with fewer and fewer water resources to go around for that population. But I think that more of the challenges in the Southwest that we see are around allocation of water. And so those are decisions about, well, should water be going to the rapidly growing cities for domestic purposes, for new developments? Should water be going to agriculture? And right now, a lot of water rights were historically granted to agricultural uses, but now there's less and less agriculture in the Southwest, and so we're seeing shifts of those water rights from agriculture to cities. And then there's all of the other species that also need and depend on water, and so how do we think about leaving water in rivers for fish to depend on, for instance? And so I guess the challenges of water scarcity are decisions that need to be made anywhere. If you're in wet Seattle, you're still deciding, well, does that water go to the city of Seattle or does it stay for agricultural use? Does it stay in rivers? But given that we're in the Southwest and we are in a place that there is less water to go around to begin with, those challenges become more acute.
One thing that I find confusing is that when people talk about water use, they talk about how we should take shorter showers and things like that, which is really a pretty small part of water use, but they don't talk about eating beef, which accounts for a very large part of water use. Help us understand where the water that we use in New Mexico is going.
To be honest, I don't know all that much about the water footprint of different uses. I do know that, as for instance, you brought up beef, that as you do move up the food chain, it takes a lot more water. That instead of just growing soybeans that we then eat, we're growing soybeans and then we're translating all of that energy and water needs into growing a cow to make hamburgers. So with every step up the chain, you do end up with more and more water needs. I can't really say that where water goes, is this much is going to water for irrigation, this much is going to domestic uses. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important that we, you know, little by little start to understand those things, and also to understand, I mean, in the presentation that you're going to be giving with Amigos Bravos, you have a beautiful picture of kind of the water cycle and the oceans and the clouds and the mountains and even steam coming from volcanoes that are all involved in the big cycle of water that we are part of as living beings. And when we think, okay, here we are in the Southwest, we're in a drought area, how should we think, I mean, we talk about watersheds and the exact watershed that we are in here in Santa Fe or in the Galisteo Basin, whatever. But how big should we think about the water system that we are an interconnected part of?
I would think about it in terms of where your water is coming from. And so most immediately, that is your local watershed in Santa Fe. That's the Galisteo Basin. And thinking about what water you're using there, how your actions are impacting the water quality in that basin. But at the same time, Santa Fe also is getting some of its water from the bigger Rio Grande watershed. That it's some of the water now coming out of the Buckman Diversion Project, for instance. And so you need to think at that slightly larger scale as well in terms of, well, as when I turn on the tap here, what impact might that be having on a fish in Mexico, say? But then actually, I don't know if you saw in the presentation, I'll be talking a little bit about the concept of virtual water, which is basically the water that's embedded in trade goods that we send around the world. And so, you know, if I buy an apple from Chile, I bought sort of a little packet of water that I bought from Chile because it's all the water that it took to grow that apple and package it and ship it to me. And so in that way, when you're buying a new computer, when you're buying, even when you're turning on a light switch, that you're impacting a watershed that may be on the other side of the world. And right. So I think a lot of it more just comes out of awareness. And I couldn't tell you in my daily life all of the different places that I interact with through using water from that place. But I think just to think about it and be aware that our actions are having pretty disparate effects that we can't necessarily see.
How clean or dirty is the water in our rivers here in New Mexico?
Ah, that's a very interesting question. Our rivers are fairly pristine in that the mountains that a lot of the snowpack is falling into, they're not heavily built up. And so there's not a ton of pollutants that's entering into the water. At the same time, though, we have a lot of historical legacies. You know, we have Los Alamos, and while they're doing a lot now to really try to clean up their act, there still are quite a few spots where there's waste that's been dumped in arroyos, and that ends up in stormwater, and that can get carried into the Rio Grande. We have also a lot of agriculture, particularly upstream in the San Luis Valley, where I am in Taos, and you can end up with E. coli in rivers from that. Moving down into Albuquerque, there's instances, Amigos Bravos has actually been doing some sampling to try to find various pharmaceuticals. So those are sort of new, these are going to be estrogens and things that are coming out of our vitamins, minerals, drugs. And they're finding some of those in the streams in the South Valley. So, you know, I don't know. Relative to the Ganges, we have a very clean river. But at the same time, there are still a lot of quite pressing concerns.
So when we look at drought in the Southwest, as you say, we've always, I mean, this is a desert. It's always been some degree of dry. But how does it compare now to, say, 100 years ago? And what direction are we going? And is it all human intervention in the environment that's causing the drought, or what's actually going on?
So it's really hard to say exactly what's going on. Relative to 100 years ago, the climate is fairly similar. But all of the projections that I've seen for what's going to happen to rainfall and snowpack in New Mexico in the coming century, for the most part, they agree that temperatures are going to be warming. And so the season where we have snowpack is shorter. And that means also that there's going to be faster, more intense runoff in the spring. There's, in terms of the summer monsoon season, I think, again, that it's less frequent rainstorms, but when they happen, they're more intense, more sort of flash flood type events. So, yeah, and I don't know enough to say this is specifically because of anthropogenic induced global warming, or if it's probably partly that and partly just more overall changes in the climate cycle. But we can expect that droughts will become more frequent.
And what are some of the costs of that drought? I mean, one thing obviously is that we've talked about on the show before and that is a real concern is tourism, fewer skiers, fewer rafters, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's definitely one of the biggest impacts of drought. And so we see if there's less snow, there's going to be less skiers. And actually, my dad just forwarded me an article from the New York Times basically saying that with climate change, the ski industry might lose a big portion of the ski industry. And it didn't mention any resorts in New Mexico specifically, but basically just that a lot of places aren't going to be able to stay open. They're not going to have snowpack for a full 100-day ski season, and that even snowmaking technology might be affected because it's getting warmer. And so even if it gets warm and the snow is melting during the day, if the nighttime temperatures are too warm, then you still can't even make the snow in the first place.
Right.
And so that's definitely a concern. And with drought, so that was just looking more specifically at climate change. But in general, with drought, we see, I know growing up in Taos, if there was a low snow year, we had a lot less people show up. And that had pretty big repercussions through the whole town's economy, not just at the ski valley. And same thing, if there's low flows and less drafting, again, pretty big hit on tourist-dependent economies.
Nicola, what do you see and what do your colleagues at Stanford see as sensible and realistic water policy for a southwestern state like New Mexico?
So part of the challenge with water policy is that there are a lot of things in place that would take a lot of momentum to change. And so, for instance, with water rights in New Mexico are allocated based on the prior appropriation system, which basically means that you get your water right fulfilled based on the seniority of that water right. So if you have a really old water right dating from 1910, you'll get your water before someone else on the river who has a water right from 1950. And so that's in place, and that's probably not going to go away anytime soon. But one of the things that actually one of my advisors here at Stanford is working on is thinking about the role of water markets to make that sort of rigid structure a little bit more dynamic. And so the idea would be that in the event of a drought, say, you could have a city like Albuquerque. It needs more water because there's not enough water in the river or in the groundwater for it to rely on because there's a drought. So what they could do is they can basically purchase water rights or more likely lease water rights from farmers in the area. And what that would mean is that the farmers would fallow their land for that year, and then Albuquerque would be able to use that water. And so what that means is that when there is water scarcity, not when we need it, that then you'd be able to shift water around between uses. So that's one idea for a good water policy. And otherwise, it's really to think about policies that are adaptive. And what I mean by that is that we put laws in place and we put management mechanisms in place, and then we monitor them. And we can learn and see, oh, hey, that wasn't working exactly the way that we intended it to. So let's try something out. And so to sort of treat management as an experiment, to say, based on all of our knowledge of the system right now, we think this is going to work. Let's try it out. Let's monitor it. And in a couple of years, if it wasn't doing what we expected it to, let's reassess and let's try out a new policy or tweak this current one.
Right.
So those are a couple of ideas.
So you will be giving a talk at the Santa Fe Community Foundation. It's part of the Water Matters series sponsored by Amigos Bravos. And when you are talking just to ordinary people who aren't involved in water policy in general, but who do live in the Southwest, what do you think it's most important for them to know?
I think one thing is that awareness that I was mentioning a little while ago, and of just realizing, well, first, yes, we live in a desert, and there are probably more people in that desert right now than it was intended to use. And so to be aware of the water that you're using and to be aware of where that water is coming from. And so it's obvious when you're drinking a glass of water, oh, I'm consuming water right now. But to also be aware of all that water, of the water that went into the electricity that you're using, the water that went into the jeans that you're wearing. So just to raise awareness of decisions that you're using to consume a resource and what effects those decisions might be having. And then secondly, I would say to learn about your watershed, to go out and take a hike along the river or go fishing. Just get outside. I think with that increased knowledge and understanding of where your water is coming from, you'll hopefully have a bit more interest to learn about what impacts your decisions are making.
Nicola Ulibarri is a student getting her PhD at the Stanford University Emmett Interdisciplinary Program in Environment and Resources. And once again, on Tuesday, the 18th of December at 5:30, she will be giving a talk called Water, the Challenge of Sustainability at the Santa Fe Community Foundation, sponsored by Amigos Bravos. It's free and open to the public. And the foundation is at 501 Helena Street on the corner of Paseo de Peralta. Thank you so much, Nicola, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to welcome back to the program Jane Davis. She is the founder and director of Hope House and Riders of the Sage New Mexico. And it's been a long time since you've been on the show.
I know, really. It's also because I had a horrible 2 years, and I kind of was reclusive, I think.
Ah.
So had an accident and went through my mother's demise and so forth. So it was a rough 2 years, but I made it. And came out smiling, and, you know.
And now you're back on the block.
Back on the block, absolutely.
So you are the founder of this organization named Hope House, and we've featured you over the years because you do a kind of eclectic mix of activities that all come from a kind of heart place.
Yes. Hope House started almost 19 years ago, so it's amazing to me to kind of see how it's grown into what the vision, you know, 19 years ago said it was going to be, which is really about being of service and letting your heart go first.
Now, when you say vision, you had an actual bona fide vision.
Right, right. And that's, I think that's talked about on the website, which is hopehouse.org, hopehouse.org. It's an acronym. And everything about Hope House continues to guide me. And it essentially told me at that time, you're going to go to New Mexico, where you're going to have 20 to 40 acres of land off the grid to be of service also. And I must say that One Heart Ranch, which also has a website, has come to fruition. And we're at the point in the spring we're going to start having workshops there. And we do a lot of work with people in prison and out of prison. So Hope House really focuses on the nonprofit and work in the prisons and so forth. We send books and we get hundreds of letters a month from inmates all over, calls from people who have been in some of our prison groups going back 25 years, who are now, there's a whole slew of guys coming out. And one of the first things they do is they get in touch with me in Hope House. And so our work is kind of transitioning to do a lot of work with people coming out of prison. And in following that vision, One Heart Ranch is now 30 magical acres of sustainable land with a wonderful solar system and water filtration, and we catch the rain and the snow, and it's awesome. So in the spring, we're going to start having workshops there.
So you actually had this vision when you were living in Atlanta that you would move to New Mexico and have 20 to 40 acre ranch. Now you've got a 30 acre ranch.
I know,
south
it's
of
wild.
Madrid. And you're doing workshops for people who have recently come out of prison?
No. See, that's where the challenge, I think, is to separate. Because we do work with prisoners, and in prison, people seem to sometimes want to pigeonhole us.
Right.
The reality is what Hope House is about is all of us. And the only reason we didn't
work...
Dog
rescue.
Everything. Right. Our dogs are therapy dogs. We now have this wonderful horse, Snickers, who you can see on the ridersofthesage-nm.com website and learn about Snickers. Who people who have been coming on Saturday mornings from 9 to 11, I have what's called drop-ins. People have to RSVP, but people can get an idea and experience the experiential work of the equine healing.
So you do equine healing with this horse that you have at the ranch?
Yes. No, she's not at the ranch. She's here in town.
Oh, okay.
She's not out there yet. There are no horses out there yet. Right now, that's just for people. But some of the guys who came out of prison helped dig the big fire pit. We have this incredible flagstone three-tier fire pit. And we've had people visit One Heart Ranch from all over the world, from Australia, from India, people affiliated with the Gandhi Center. It's been drawing people, but now it's really ready and more comfortable.
So tell us about the equine healing work that you're doing.
A couple of people have been coming regularly on Saturday morning, and the words that they've used to describe it are spiritual alignment, which I found fascinating. Also, amazing is what people... I did a workshop for 6 therapists so that they could get an idea of the difference between being with the horse and experiencing things. And 2 of them have come back to do more work, with themselves and are sending, some of their clients. And so it really is experiential, and the horses are herd animals. So they want to connect with you,
yeah.
And they're also prey. They're predator to no one. So the reason it's so amazing to work with a horse in a healing situation or even a therapeutic situation is because the horse gives me answers. You might show up and say, oh, I'm fine. And I've done a lot of pro bono work with veterans with PTSD. And some show up with bravado, but inside they're terrified of the horse. Well, the horse knows that, because all of a sudden, if this person shows up and is appearing to be fine and strong, the horse is reading what's inside. So when the horse responds, I know that this person is not showing up with authenticity. And so that helps me do my end of the work. So I see the horse as my co-therapist. And the other day, someone was doing a session, and they were just talking, and Snickers was on the other side of the pen. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Snickers comes walking over directly to this person and puts her nose on the person's heart.
Good heavens.
And just stood there. And so there are all these amazing things that happen with the horse. And I've done, therapy with clients in offices. But this work is amazing. And my office is a little tough shed. And so, I have a propane heater. So it's very grassroots, which brings people also to just to be with the earth, to be with the surroundings. And a few Saturdays ago, we had 5 people in the group. It was raining, it was freezing, then it was sleeting, and it was windy. And I said to everyone, of course anybody can leave, but everyone's here for change. And to make a change, it's uncomfortable. It's not easy. So we get the experience of being able to stand in this horrible weather and learn from it and be with it and learn to be comfortable in the uncomfortable. And that's when change will happen. So the Riders of the Sage, that's what we offer. I mean, at everybody's stage, which was amazing. And one person commented, he said, I just became aware, and he's 67. He said, I just learned something. All my life, even in relationships, when it's uncomfortable, I want to leave. And I have. And he said, I really wanted to go into that little shed because it was more comfortable, but I stayed. You know, so it's that kind of experience you get to take away. And so.
We're talking to Jane Davis of Hope House. One of the things I think is really admirable and interesting about the work you do is it's basically about developing ongoing relationships with people, with animals. And you've been doing it for almost 20 years, and there's a lot of things that happen in 20 years that you can't do when you come in all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and in 1 year you can accomplish a few things. But, for example, you've had people who were in prison and have gotten out of prison, and you helped them with that transition. And do you have any updates on those folks? How are they doing?
Yeah, I think, as you know, years ago we brought Rod, who was like a son to me.
He was in prison.
Mm-hmm. As a juvenile.
That's right. Because he was a young guy, and he came to Santa Fe. He was on the show briefly.
Yes. He was 14 when he contacted me, and we worked together. He started calling. My thing is I don't help or fix anybody. And I help people empower themselves. And also, I will not work with anyone who's innocent, because that's a whole different, you know, then they need good lawyers. So I always tell people, I can only work with you if you're guilty, because then we have something to work on if you want to make change. And so everything that I'm doing is connected, whether it's One Heart Ranch, Riders of the Sage, or Hope House. So Rod is now, you know, he got married, has two kids. Unfortunately, they divorced. And he always was drawn to the Southwest because of, you know, us. I mean, he came to visit me numerous times, and he's doing great. He just moved to Phoenix, and he's doing well. And I always laugh with him because he always will land on his feet. And he's had a tough time of things, but since he was 14, I mean, he's been empowered, and he just keeps at it. He's had slips. And Jelaine, who also I think was on the show with us, she's married with a little boy, and she's still in Atlanta and happy as could be. So, you know, she came off the streets. And then there, I just got a call 3 weeks ago from one of the men that had been in my federal prison group. And you know, 2 weeks after he was out, he called, and one of the guys came out who had started the Scared Straight program in 1976. So I think that the example that I set and I empower others to set is relationship.
Yeah.
And you care about people. So it's not like, oh, well, I care about you and then, you know, I'm out of here. And there are a number of people here in town, in New Mexico, who were in the groups and who now, you know, contact, they're doing well. And
it's hard to get out of prison if you've been in for a long time. It's hard to get out no matter what. But if you've been in for a long time, you have an institutionalized mentality.
Yeah.
Everything is done for you. You haven't been around. I mean, I think I've had the experience of people not understanding that anybody can just like you and love you and not want anything from you.
Right.
I mean, just learning what regular, right, everyday relationships,
right,
are like is a big learning curve, and a lot of people aren't willing to go through it with recently released people.
Right, because that could be scary, you know, and I think part of what I like to do, and this is why I so appreciate you having me on the show, is maybe to plant some seeds in terms of education, because the guys coming out and the women coming out of prison need us, need community to help them.
Yeah.
And so I think what Hope House has always been kind of outside the box. You know, we're not a halfway house. We're not traditional anything. We really empower the people. And I think that's the word that stands out. And we connect. And the work with the horse at Riders of the Sage. So, again, this isn't about prisoners. We all need to learn how to connect and how to communicate and how to set boundaries. And so, for me, the three entities of my life, Hope House, Riders of the Sage, and One Heart Ranch, all combine the same principles. Connection, contact, communication, authenticity, and hopefully, to me, that grows into peace. That's what peace is. when people can be authentic with themselves. And the elements of Hope House, the eye, the heart, the hand, honesty, faith, and action, really combines a spiritual action that simplifies everything. But every step you take, if you can learn to really be honest with yourself, and you can't be that honest unless you have faith in something outside your ego. And then the hand is to always give back to community, to yourself, to service, to the animals, and to be present as a real loving being. And so I feel blessed. I sit here now and go, oh, my God, am I done? You know, so I've created Hope House, Riders of the Sage, and One Heart Ranch. And I said, I created. I didn't create. I don't feel like I've done anything. It's come through me, and I just stayed focused for these 20 years, and now I feel like I'm waking up from a dream and going, okay, now what? All right, people, contact me. Let's do this together. You know, we've got these great entities.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is if listeners feel a spark of connection with you and want to get involved in the work, how can they participate?
They can call me either at 983-6677, and that's kind of the number for everything. Or they can go online, they can look on Facebook. All of these entities are on Facebook. On Facebook, we're Riders of the Sage. There's One Heart Ranch, and of course, there's Hope House. So,
and if you just go to hopehouse.org, and it's hope-house.org, you can connect to all of it.
Yes, yes. Or Riders of the Sage or One Heart Ranch.
Okay. Well, Jane Davis it can be found at all of these websites and can be found here in the Santa Fe Bacon
and
Company.
Join in their other, their community members who were, you know, involved in doing things. And, you know, everything that I'm putting out there to offer is experiential. Get out of your heads, get into your hearts, and let's walk this walk together.
Jane, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and happy holidays to
you. Happy holidays, and thanks. It's been great to be back.
I'm happy now to welcome back to the show Deborah Tang. She's Executive Director of St. Elizabeth's Shelter here in Santa Fe, and Jim Podesta is Director of Development there. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for having us on.
It's always good to have you and hear what's going on. It's a wonderful shelter that you run and have been running for some time now, Deborah, and it's more than a shelter. What do you have going on at St. Elizabeth? You've got quite a lot of programs.
Yeah, we have the main shelter for men, which is on Allred Street, but then we have a women and family shelter that's called Casa Familia, and it's for single women and families. And then we also have one transitional program, two-year program for families, and that's 2 and 3 bedroom apartments, and then two permanent supportive housing programs, one for seniors and one for people with disabilities.
It highlights the reality that there's so many people and so many different demographics of people,
right,
who are needing shelter, who do not have a proper place to live.
Right. And we actually, our goal is not to just house people, give them a place to sleep, but it really to restore them back to wholeness and get them housed. And in that effort, we've really been looking at our programs and trying to figure out what works best. And we found with the Casa Familia, with our women and families, that it's taking a little longer. And if we just hang with people a little bit longer, invest in them with case management and support, that they do much better. And so that one time being homeless becomes just one time, and it's not a cycle where they have to keep coming back over and over again if we work a little bit longer and a little bit harder. So we've taken that model, and we've been applying it to the men's shelter. And so if people are working on their goals, if they're working towards housing, or, you know, that process of getting housing or getting a job, those kinds of things that will help them stabilize, then we let them stay longer so that they can complete those goals. So if they're getting close, if we can see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, we really work with them. And prior to that, our success rate for people who move from our shelter into housing was about 40%. And now we've just started this program of letting people stay a little bit longer as they're working towards their goals. And we actually are seeing over 50% now.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so it really is making a big difference. And that's our goal, is to not see them again, that they become successful, that they become stabilized, they find housing, and they don't become homeless in the future.
The last time you were here, I think we talked about how many people who were formerly prosperous members of the middle class, so-called middle class, are suddenly homeless.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you lose a job, especially if your job didn't pay a whole heck of a lot to begin with. You don't have a little bundle of savings. And so it doesn't take very long from losing that job to not being able to sustain yourself financially.
Yeah, in our society, you lose your job, you lose your health insurance for most people. Then you get sick and, you know, what savings you have can rapidly disappear.
Right. And so these are folks who were, I mean, it seemed like a lot of them are not people who have any particular problems themselves, such as mental illness or, I mean, there's different groups that you have, but a lot of people really don't have any particular problems except economic problems, which
right.
are far bigger than they.
Right, right. Or and it may be a skill set. So what they really need is, you know, some kind of training at the community college or someplace to get the skills that they need to be more marketable in the workplace.
What do some of the success stories look like? I mean, without revealing any confidentiality, but the kind of things that you're seeing.
We can have, like, one story I was told is we had a woman, young woman, in her early 20s who was living in Taos, and her mother, and her mother got involved with some man, and man moved in, and it was just not a good situation, I think. I'm not sure, but, you know, some, I think, drug use, things like that. And she just wanted to leave, so she left house, came down here, had no place to stay. Ended up at our Casa Familia program. And there, I mean, this is very similar to what you're talking about. No identifiable physical, mental, behavioral, alcohol, drug problems, but without a place to stay and without any resources. And we were able to, at the program, they worked with her. They helped her find a job. She got a job at Dillard's thanks to a generous community. There were a lot of clothes donated there, some which fit her. So she was outfitted, presentable enough to pass an interview situation. And from what I've told, I think the manager of Casa Familia said that Dillard's has put her in their managerial training program. You know, so because, you know, so she's young and, you know, presentable and success. So it's just, you know, she was disoriented when she came here, so just got her stabilized, gave her the opportunity, and let her succeed, you know, giving her the groundwork, framework, so she can succeed on her own.
Right.
But one thing, Mary Charlotte, interesting about this recession is how it's really changed the demographics we've been seeing. I mean, I would say now, in our program, at this time, we have someone from almost newborn up to an 80-year-old woman, you know, at Casa Familia. It's just of all sorts. And that, I don't think we had several years ago, that range of people.
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot of, you know, 40, 50, 60-year-old women that have just been, you know, because of life situations, or sometimes it's family problems, like they have children of which they expend all their resources on, children in crisis, and then they bankrupt themselves, and then they end up homeless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You also do have disabled people with various disabilities who are homeless, presumably because of some of the challenges they're facing.
Right. And a lot of times when we initially see them, they don't realize that they've been through trauma and that they've got some real coping skills problems that they need to really work on. And so we don't provide those services. We refer to LifeLink or the Guidance Center or some of the other programs around town, and try and get them into a situation where they can emotionally stabilize. And then once they're emotionally stabilized, then either they are able to work or they need disability. And so we work with them depending on where they are. So it really is an individualized kind of approach, looking at each person or each family situation and addressing that.
And the goal is, you know, to connect them. You know, our caseworkers can connect them to available resources in the community so that once they, best case scenario, move on into housing of their own, they have these other resources that they can turn to help them maintain their housing, maintain their independence to whatever level that may be. Their self-reliance, I guess.
Yeah, which is, of course, what we're all hoping for. I mean, it's a funny thing because nobody's really self-reliant. We're all incredibly dependent on one another and dependent on our environment and our ecosystems and all of that. But there's something about being able to take home a paycheck and pay your rent and buy your food that is incredibly important for a sense of well-being.
Right, right. And social capital, knowing who to call when you have a problem so that you can get back on your feet as quickly as possible, I think is important.
And I think one of our challenges we face in this recession is it seems to have inordinately hit families, particularly younger families. And I think the last stat I saw was 37.5% of the homeless people in the country now are families, you know, that cohort. So that's one thing. We're very fortunate that we opened up Casa Familia in 2009 to address that situation, because I'm going to let Deborah talk about this, but the deleterious effects of homelessness on young children is like been incredibly documented. So,
yeah, well, you know, there have been lots of, you know, bedwetting, trauma, those kinds of things, doing poorly in school.
Right.
There are a lot of side effects to not knowing where you're going to sleep at night and not being sure if mom and dad are going to be around tomorrow. And so, you know, we really work with the families. It's a special situation for kids, because it can affect their whole lives.
Yeah, very much so. It's their formative years.
Right.
Yeah, and the less time, you know, the less time you spend homelessness. I think they've done studies, too. The less time people are homeless, the better, the far greater the chance they will not become homeless again. I mean, majority of people are homeless for a short stretch of time. You know, you obviously see people who are homeless for years and years and years, but that's really a smaller, much smaller percentage of the homeless population.
Yeah, and those are the people you have your stereotype about, which is the homeless Vietnam vet or something like that, who's an alcoholic.
Yeah. So what they found is the shorter period of time people are homeless, the quicker they can get on their feet, the more likely they are to stay housed once they get back on their feet. And so that's our goal, is to really, you know, take that period of time, whether it's 60 days, make that 45 days or 30 days, so that people get into housing as quickly as possible. And we're working with the city 5-year plan to end homelessness.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how that was going.
Yeah, so we presented that on Wednesday night to the city council. And in that plan, it really is about, you know, shortening that time, which would mean that we need more housing vouchers, more support services, so that people can get stabilized quicker.
So what kind of help do you need at the shelter right now? Do you need donations of money, clothing, food, time?
Right. So every year...
All of the above.
Yeah. Yeah. Every year, you know, we get a tremendous outpouring, and it's usually between Thanksgiving and New Year's. And we really rely on that. That kind of helps us get through the next year. And, you know, we use that money to keep the lights on, to keep housing going. But we also use it for case managers to really work with people to get them off the street and get them housed. And so it really is crucial to us to have those donations. And in the past few years, it's been kind of scary. We've been scrambling, worried about whether we're going to be able to keep the lights on and keep, you know, people working. So it would be really great if your listeners would help us in supporting this.
Ladies
really
and gentlemen,
important
Christmas and holiday spirit, it's a really good time to make your year-end donations to all the worthy folks in your life and organizations, but this is a very important one, because this is really people living on the edge, where really all of us could be if things went a little bit wrong.
Right. That's true. Yeah, Mary Charlotte. The donations go really, they're really investments in human potential. I see it. 70% of our annual budget comes from philanthropic giving. We get about 25% or so, 25 to 27% from government grants, and then a little bit amount from other things, but the great majority of our donations come from individuals, and that's what keeps the place going.
From Santa Fans.
From Santa Fans.
That's right.
That is correct.
Now, what about food and clothing?
Clothing is always needed, particularly at this time of year, and particularly warm winter clothing.
Socks,
gloves,
jackets.
Hats, scarves, jackets,
okay.
Boots.
Right.
Yeah, very much needed. And we always need personal hygiene supplies, those things you get in your motel room. The little jars of soap, the little shampoos,
yeah. The mini
disposable razors, that stuff. Because when people come in to the shelter, that's what we give them, you know, for their showers and things like that.
Right. I bet there's a lot of stuff that many of our listeners have seven of.
Mm.
Combs, you know.
Yeah, right.
And things like that, that they could just make a basket and bring it in.
And Whole Foods has been very generous this year. And they designated us as their grab and give. So we've been getting a pallet or two of food every week since the beginning of November.
How does that work?
So people are asked, I think at the checkout counter, if they would like to participate, and they can either buy a breakfast, a lunch, or a dinner. And then that money is put into ordering the food, and we pick it up every week. It's really wonderful.
So do you need volunteers? Are you looking for volunteers around the holidays? Or?
Well, usually we get lots of phone calls wanting to prepare food or do something on Thanksgiving and Christmas, and we have plenty of people, usually a year in advance, people who want to do something on those two particular days. What we really need is all the other 363 days of the year.
For example, December 26th.
Yeah, yeah. And so we have wonderful volunteers. We have church groups, civic groups, high school classes that come and help prepare meals. For the men's shelter, we could use that help with the resource center, which is at the Old Pete's Pets location. It's the
right.
One stop for homeless services. We do a lunch on Tuesdays and Fridays there. We could certainly use help with all. I mean, it's not only that. It's if somebody has computer skills. I mean, we have lots of volunteer opportunities.
Right. It's not just preparing the meals. We need people to check people in, to register people, to help them go, because this resource center, it's not just our meals. There's healthcare for the homeless is there. There's
right.
Counseling there. So it's just, you know, we also need people to help direct people. So you don't have to just be, if you don't like food, there's other things one could do there.
Okay.
Right. And all of our programs could use volunteers. We couldn't do it without volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, we're 365 days of the year. Every dinner at the men's shelter, most of the dinners at Casa Familia are provided by volunteers. I mean, and volunteers work at the desk. They volunteer staffing the front desk. I mean, the organization could not exist without volunteers. We're hard pressed enough to pay for the people we have working there.
Right,
we're
mad
to pay for the volunteers who provide help for us as well.
Well, a shout out to the great volunteers that volunteer at St. Elizabeth's Shelter and all these other organizations that are associated with it. And if anybody is interested in volunteering, the number is 982-6611. Deborah Tang is Executive Director of St. Elizabeth's Shelter, and Jim Podesta is Director of Development there. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.